Hey everybody, I'm Jerry. I'm a drunk. It's good to see you all. Tonight we're going to talk about step 10, but I want to just, before we do that, you know, how we got here, step 10 is what the beginning of what we call the maintenance steps, and we've worked by this time through steps 1 through 9. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. 2, came to believe the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to it. First one is the admission, getting honest. Then we come to believe there's a power greater than ourselves and make a decision, okay? And part of that decision, I believe, is getting into the action steps. And one of the ways that we can look back and know that we've made a decision is if we have gotten into the action steps. Every once in a while, I run into somebody who, you know, wants to get sober in AA without doing the steps. And if I try to sponsor them, I don't know another way to sponsor people other than the steps. That's the program of recovery. They might be working another program, you know, BB, but it's not AA. I don't know what it is, you know. But AA, the 12 steps of AA, is the program of recovery. And in steps 4 and 5, we start to get honest with ourselves about ourselves, and then we get honest with ourselves and with another person about ourselves when we admit it. Step 6 and 7, we begin to look at these character defects. We become willing to have God remove them, and we ask Him. And steps 8 and 9 is the end of the house cleaning, the massive house cleaning that we have to do, cleaning up the wreckage of the past. And the way I liken this was, you know, I won't talk about being a slob tonight. You know, last time I did, I spilled drinks all over the place, and just, I mean, I convinced you all I was definitely a slob, but I lived in that, at the end of my drinking, I lived in that sleazebag motel room at Expressway Inn, and by the end of my 6 months sojourn there, you had to wear snowshoes just to stay on top of the garbage. I mean, there was no cleaning that room out. I had to burn it down with a flare gun. But that's kind of the way our lives get, you know? I mean, we just keep piling on the garbage and piling on the garbage, and it seems like when I was trying to come in and out of AA without doing the steps, I'd come out of the fog and I'd look at this pile of garbage and I'd say, I can't handle this, and go back in the fog, you know, and then I couldn't handle that anymore, and then I'd come back in out after piling some more garbage on it. Look at it again, so it's worse now than ever. Go back in the fog and keep that process up over and over and over again. And finally, AA handed me some tools, you know, a pitchfork, and a shovel. And they said, how about if you clean up the garbage next time you come out of the fog? And those are the tools that we're using here in these steps, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And 8 and 9, we're beginning to make amends wherever possible, unless to do so would harm somebody else, harm others, the people we're making amends to or innocent people. But that's just the beginning, okay? That's just the beginning. And if we think we can work steps through 9 and then rest on our laurels, we're kind of sadly mistaken about that. See, what happens is, as an alcoholic, even though I'm trying to clean up the wreckage of the past, I have developed some long-standing, my response to life is something that is not going to change overnight because I one time made a list of what I had done wrong, admitted to somebody, made a decision to turn it over, became willing to turn it over to God and ask Him to remove it, and then made amends one time. Okay? And I don't know if you all can imagine what the change, what the life of change is after step 9, but it begins with step 10. Anybody, any of you ladies, I was going to use the example of learning to drive a stick shift, okay? But I learned to drive a stick shift on a tractor when I was about 12 years old. But I had to teach my wife how to drive a stick shift when we first got married. You know what that was like? She was only used to driving an automatic. I'd say it was an experience. I finally decided there was one safe place where I could take her to teach her to drive a stick shift, and that was this. We lived in Fort Lauderdale, and it was this graveyard that had nice, long, winding, you know. And I figured, what the hell? Everybody there is already dead. You know, she can't do a whole lot of arms. So we went down to this graveyard, and I'm trying to teach her how to drive a stick shift. And she had to think about every move. I mean, it was like, okay, now, what's this third pedal for? No, yeah, and you know, put your foot on the clutch. Okay, now, you know, put it in neutral. Okay, start it up. All right, now let up on the emergency brake. Okay, easy on the gas and easy let your foot up on the clutch, you know. And, you know, and I mean, we at one point in time, we were jerking down the road in the cemetery, and it was in a convertible, and the car was going back and forth like this, you know, and just, and she was spilling my beer. I was getting very upset. We started laughing because she kept saying, "What do I do?" I said, "Put your foot on the clutch. Put your foot on the clutch." She says, "Which one's the clutch?" And in the meantime, we started laughing, and she couldn't concentrate enough to put her foot on. I mean, we just jerking down this road until it finally stalled out. The caretaker came and chased us out. You know, have you no respect for the dead? I mean, it was just terrible. But anyway, that's, you know, if she gets in a car now and drives my stick shift. I mean, she can drive to school in a stick shift and doesn't even know how she's getting. I mean, steer with a leg, you know, got a Big Mac in one hand and a coffee in the other, you know, and, you know, shove it into gear with her elbow and not even think about it. Not even think about it. That did not happen overnight, okay? If any of you remember, probably the ladies remember it more than a guy. I don't know if the guys remember it, you know, if he had as much trouble learning how to drive a stick shift. But you, if you remember it, it's like you got to concentrate about every move. If you had to all of a sudden move to England, my son is in the Air Force and he's getting transferred to England. I said, okay, now you got to remember they drive on the left-hand side of the road over there. All right? If you all of a sudden had to move to England and you had to learn how to drive on the left-hand side of the road, I mean, a lot of people get discouraged trying to do that because everything is the opposite of what you're used to. Not only do you have to drive on the left-hand side of the road, but when you turn left, you turn into the nearest lane. You know, you always want to go over into the far lane. What's that guy? You know, honk the horn at him. Get out where you belong. You know, that type of thing. And when you turn right, you got to turn into the far lane. I mean, everything is just the opposite. And the steering wheel's on the wrong side of the car. I mean, all kinds of crazy things. But if you lived there long enough, I mean, when you started driving, you'd have to think about every move. You know, be careful of what I'm doing. I don't end up on the wrong side of the road and have a head on. And why is the steering wheel over on this side? And, you know, what's going on here, and they have to think about every single move, and it's constant concentration. But if you live there for 2 or 3 years, you'd get used to driving on the left-hand side of the road. It would get to be natural to you. You wouldn't think about it, just like driving a stick shift. If you drove a stick shift for a long enough period of time, even though it took a lot of effort in the beginning, okay, after a while, it'd get to be natural. In fact, it would get to be maybe more natural to you than driving an automatic. It happened to me. I got so used to driving a stick shift, I took my wife's station wagon out one day and stepped on the clutch. Wasn't the clutch. And went to shift gears, you know, that type of thing. But it gets to be very automatic after a while. Well, what happens in this program is we have learned ways of reacting to life. And my ways that I learned to reacting to life over a period of 22 years of drinking was, to say the least, rather warped. My ways of reacting to other people was rather warped. I mean, I felt like I was on constant attack, and I was constantly either defending or, more likely, attacking. You know, if somebody looked at me cross-eyed, I wouldn't wait until they attacked. I'd go ahead and counterattack before they even got their, you know, first words out of their mouth. And it was just as a byproduct of the way I lived for all those years. If someone asked me a question, I had this experience when I was first sober. First job I had sober was working at a magazine as their advertising sales manager. And once a month, the proofs would come out, and I'd have to work late because I would have to correct the proofs for all the ads, make sure they're perfect, and then get them to the printers so that the magazine could go, you know, into print the next day. And one night, when I first started working there, The proofs came out. I called my wife and I said, "Honey, I'm going to be late. I don't know how late I'm going to be," because I really didn't, because I never knew how many corrections there were going to be. I said, "I'll call you when I leave. You know, I just got to stay and do some work here." So I started working on it and going through the proofs, and there weren't that many corrections. And about 7:30, I got done. Okay, so I thought, "Oh, you know, I mean, I'm still used to going to a meeting a day. I thought I can still make it to an AA meeting." So I jumped in my car without even thinking about calling Ann. I said, "Well, she's, you know, she probably thinks I'm working late anyway, so I'll just go to the meeting and call her after the meeting." Zipped on over to the Central Club and went down to the San Marco Club for the Central Group for the 8 o'clock meeting. Got done with the meeting, you know, and got home. And guess what she did? Same thing she always did for the first month, 6 months I walked in the door sober. You know, smell your breath when you walk in, when she kisses you. Yeah, I don't know why she did that, you know. I mean, not like I was lying that time. And she says, so how did it, you work late, huh? I says, yeah. She says, well, how did it go? And I said, well, it wasn't too bad. She says, where were you really? I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, I called about 7:45 and there was no answer. And I said, oh, yeah, I remember. That's when I had diarrhea, man. I had to go to the back. And first thing out of my mouth was a lie without even thinking about it. I had gotten so used to lying that the first thing out of my mouth when I felt like I was being attacked was a lie. Get defensive and get dishonest and come up with some rationalization, some explanation that just didn't make any sense. And in the middle of it, I caught myself and I said, wait a minute, what am I doing? I don't need to lie. I was going to an AA meeting, for crying out loud. And I stopped myself in the middle of it and I said, Ann, I don't know why I'm saying this. I got done early, about 7:30, and I went to the Central Club, to the Central Group. She says, well, why did you lie? And I said, I had no idea. And I had to think about that. Why did I lie? The thing is, it had gotten to be an automatic response. All right? After 22 years of daily drinking, when you come home and your wife says, where you been? All right? You know, you say, honey, you call her up and you say, honey, I'm just going to stop off and have a couple of beers with the guys after work. She says, what time are you going to be home? Oh, 7. Are you sure? Yeah, 7, no problem. And then you get home at about 3:00 in the morning and she wants to know where you've been. You know, well, you come up with some alibi, some excuse, because you can't tell her the truth, which is, I don't know, I was in a blackout. You know, let me check my matchbook covers and see what I got here. Okay, that type of thing. Because you wouldn't believe that either. See, you get used to coming up with these elaborate stories. And it was so ingrained that automatically, without me thinking about it, the first thing out of my mouth was an elaborate story. Okay. But I was able to catch myself in the moment and say, this doesn't make sense. And just tell her, hey, I went to a meeting. I'm sorry. I don't know why I was saying this. And I stopped and think about that. Honesty, I think, is progressive, too. You know, I lied so much my dog didn't believe me when I called it. You know, that's just terrible. But it talks in step 10. There's some things in here. Step 10, we continue to take a personal inventory to set right any new mistakes as we go along. You know, I gave the example of that room being a total disaster at the end of 6 months, living in that Expressway Inn motel room, drinking and just letting the garbage literally pile up. Okay? Well, figuratively, that's what happened in my life. Well, when I moved back there, believe it or not, I moved back there after getting out of jail and setting the place on fire. And I had made an arrangement with Mr. Bedell, the owner and the manager, to repair the room. That was part of the bargain for me being able to get out. So he let me live in the same room while I started to repair it, you know, paint the walls white again. They were all black with soot. You know, it was just a disaster. I had to go through that thing and just totally clean the whole place out. I mean, pull everything out, just scrub it down to the bare walls, repaint everything, and then put new stuff back in there and pay for it. Well, once I had done that, if I went back to my old way of living and just let the garbage pile up, in another 6 months, it would have been in the same shape. So what did I have to do? I had to kind of keep it up on a day-to-day basis. You know, go in there and dust once in a while. Go in there and take out the garbage instead of just letting it lay on a floor, that type of thing. And that's kind of what the 10th step is in our lives. We've gotten done doing the major house cleaning, the major overhaul, ripping out all the carpets, scrubbing down the walls and the floor, painting everything, putting new carpets, new furniture back in there. We get our room, our house in order, so to speak. And if we want to keep it in order, what we have to do then is a certain maintenance program on that. There's a lot of ways that it says that it is easy to let up on a spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels after step 9. You know, we think we've done pretty good, and it's easy to do that. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured. We are not cured. I don't suffer from alcoholism. You know, I suffer from alcoholism. If I take the alcohol out, all the ism is still in there, you know, and that's what I got to deal with on a daily basis. We are not cured of alcoholism. And I often said, I think the first sign of a relapse is a person feeling that they're being cured. Because what happens as soon as I'm cured? Well, I don't have to go to those meetings as much anymore. And gee, I really don't need to call a sponsor. And I'm not that bad. I don't need to do this 10th step. You know, and we stop doing the things that we need to do to maintain our sobriety. In the big book, it says, what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on a maintenance of our spiritual condition. And that really struck me when I read that. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. You know, my wife couldn't understand. She didn't go to Al-Anon for quite a while after I got into the program, until I told her, you know, she booted me out after 11 years of drinking, and I was with her for 1 year sober, and I said, honey, I don't know how you put up with me as long as you did, but if you don't change, I'm going to boot you out, you know? Yeah, I mean, because there was really a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of it was going on with her. She was an adult child of an alcoholic, and there's a lot of, you know, expectations of what my behavior was and what it ought to be and so forth. And she really needed, well, I can't take her inventory, but she eventually went to, I'll tell you what happened. I was going to meeting a day, right? I was going to a meeting a day. There were a couple times when she wanted to know, why do I have to keep going to those meetings? My first year, I went to a meeting a day. I was terrified not to tell you the truth, because I know what I did in my evenings when I wasn't going to a meeting. And my sponsor said 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did that, and then I just kept on going. You know, and I said, well, how long do I have to go to all these meetings? And he said, or how many meetings do I have to go to? And he said, well, how often did you drink? And I said, every day. And he said, well, what are you going to do with all that free time now that you're not drinking, Jerry? I mean, really scared the hell out of me. So I just kept going to meetings. I kept going to just about a meeting a day for the first year. And my wife, I came home one night, and we were having a tough time. We were $40,000 in debt when I got sober. We had lost our house, and we were working our way out of all this stuff. And I came home, and I mean, she was in tears. She was sitting there in the living room, and I said, what's wrong? You know, I walked in the door, and I said, what's wrong? And it was about 6 o'clock. I was going to grab some dinner before rushing out to a meeting. She says, the landlord called, the rent's overdue, and they're going to turn off the power, and they're going to repossess the car, and all this stuff was going on, and, you know, and the kids were terrible, and the dog has fleas, and I want to know what you're going to do about it. You know, and I started backpedaling my way out of the door. I'm going to get my ass to a meeting, you know. I said, she almost leaped out of that chair. I thought she was going to claw my eyes out. She grabbed me by the collar and, no, you're not listening again. You're going to sit here and solve these problems, you know. And I was working two jobs at that time. I said, what do you want me to do? You know, I'm doing the best. I'm working two jobs. I'm going to meetings. I'm staying sober. So what do you want me to do? And she says, I don't know, but I can't handle this. I'm going nuts. And I said, well, honey, why don't you go to a meeting? She says, I'm not a drunk. I said, well, go to an Al-Anon meeting. You know, that was a mixed blessing. Anyway, she said, go to an Al-Anon meeting. And she said, we can't afford it. I said, it's free. You know, I mean, you don't even have to put a dollar in a basket. Yeah, but we can't afford a babysitter. We don't need a babysitter. Yeah, but you're going to go to a meeting. You always do. I said, no, I'll stay home with the kids. You go. You need it worse than I do, you know. And she went. Okay, she went to her first Al-Anon meeting. And she came home, and I said, well, how was it? And she went, whoa! She just broke into tears, and I said, what's wrong? She says, all they did was talk to me, and I just cried. And they put their arms around me and told me it was going to be all right and keep coming back. And she says, I don't think it's going to do any good. And I said, well, I said, honey, I said, and she went, before she went, she said, I need a psychiatrist and we can't afford it. And that's why I said, go to Al-Anon, it's free. And she said, I said, honey, if you went to the psychiatrist, you wouldn't expect to be cured after one session, would you? And she says, no. And I said, well, what did they tell you? Well, they said to go to 6 meetings and then decide. She says, okay, go to 6 meetings. And she did. She went to 6 meetings. And then she turned down to a third degree Al-Anon black belt. You know. Al-Anons are great. I love them dearly. I mean, they can work this program and drink, too. I don't know how they do that. You know. And, we have a slip. We go out and die. And, you know, to them, it's just a mad moment of compassion or whatever. But, sorry. Thank you. But anyway, at one point in time, before she went to Al-Anon, she said, and she's diabetic, she has to take insulin twice a day. And I've almost lost her a couple of times. I thank God that I was sober. She became diabetic, adult onset diabetic, after I got sober. I almost lost her a couple of times. One time she was choking on her own vomit and I had to give her mouth to mouth to keep her alive because she had stopped breathing in the middle of the night. And she had to take insulin on a daily basis, and she had to monitor her blood sugar on a daily basis, and she had to do certain things, watch her diet, watch her exercise on a daily basis. And when she did those things, she was just, I mean, she could live a perfectly normal, happy life. Go out, she got a job teaching, she could teach, she could do all these wonderful things, okay? She led a perfectly normal, happy life as long as she did the things that she was supposed to do on a daily basis. Well, she was saying to me, why do you have to keep going to those meetings? Are you going to a meeting again? Why do you got to keep going back? And I didn't know how to answer. All I knew was keeping me sober. And I knew, and she knew two things. She liked me better sober than she did drunk. Okay, she never asked me to leave sober, okay? She liked me better sober than she did drunk. And one time, just to try, kind of make a point to her, I said, well, honey, I said, she said, well, are you going to a meeting again? You got to go to another meeting? I said, yeah. Well, listen, honey, did you take your insulin this morning? She says, well, yeah. I said, you plan on taking, you took it this afternoon? Yeah. Do you plan on taking it tomorrow? She says, well, of course. I said, I'll tell you what, tomorrow, why don't you just take a day off? She said, what? I said, why don't you just take a, don't worry about the insulin tomorrow. In fact, we'll go out and have a hot fudge sundae and celebrate together. You know, you can have one and I'll have one. She looked at me, she says, are you nuts? I said, well, no, I mean, you took your insulin today and you're planning on taking the day after tomorrow, right? Well, yeah, well, just take a day off. She says, Jerry, I can't do that. I said, well, why not? She says, Jerry, I'm diabetic. If I take a day off and don't take my insulin and eat a hot fudge sundae, I could go into a coma, I could die. I said, that's right. I said, and I have a disease too. My disease is alcoholism. And if I stop doing the things that I need to do on an ongoing basis, then I could go out and pick up a drink, and I could die. And I think finally she began to understand what I was talking about in terms of a maintenance program. Well, part of that maintenance program is this 10 step, something that I have to do on an ongoing basis. This is not an overnight matter. Change is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Sounds like the 6th and 7th step, right? When we're continuing to watch for these things, sounds like the 4th and 5th step. We discuss them with someone immediately. Sounds like the 5th step. And make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Sounds like the 8th and 9th step. You know, these maintenance steps are a combination of the steps that we've just completed, and we do this on an ongoing basis to keep our room clean. There's one other thing it talks about. It talks about sometimes when we do this, and it talks about combining this with the 11th step, which I'm not planning on getting on tonight, but when did I ever plan? It says when we retire at night, and when he's talking about the 11th step, he says when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Where were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others? Of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. This is all in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it doesn't talk a whole lot about it, but it's basically, it's got some of the keys in that thing. There is a, when it begins talking about the 10th step and the 12 and 12, it says another very important thing, I think. As we work the first 9 steps, we prepare ourselves for the adventure of a new life. But when we approach step 10, we commence to put our AA way of living to practical use, day by day, in fair weather or foul. Then comes the acid test. This is what I think is important. Can we stay sober, keep an emotional balance, and live to good purpose under all conditions? And this is what step 10 addresses. We don't just get sober, and then stop working. Now it's a matter of staying sober. And it's just like my wife with her diabetes. Once she learns about it and gets it under control and finds out what she has to do, she needs to continue to do certain things on an ongoing basis if she's going to be able to operate and function normally in this world and stay healthy and stay alive. Well, once I've learned some of the things that I need to do, and really learning that is part of the process of going through the 9 steps, I need to kind of keep that process up in step 10 in the beginning of the maintenance steps. A continuous look at our assets and liabilities and a real desire to learn and grow by this means are necessities. And I heard a saying once that when your liability is in alcohol, your asset's in jail. So I don't know if that's true or not. It talks about some different kinds of inventories. It says there's a spot check inventory taken at any time of the day when we find ourselves getting tangled up. And that, you know, when I start finding myself getting all tied up in knots, usually there's something wrong with me. My sponsor used to quote a phrase in this thing that just killed me when he would do this. I hated to hear this, but it was always true. He used to say, "It is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us." You know, I didn't want it always to be I had to look at me, but the truth is, even if someone else is at fault, what is my reaction to that? Okay, and a lot of times my reaction to it is the same old reaction. I act out of fear, and out of fear comes anger, and out of anger comes some kind of response to a situation that's totally out of whack. And a lot of times that has to do with my way of looking at things. Then there's the inventory we take at day's end when we review the happenings of the hours just passed. Here we cast up a balance sheet, crediting ourselves with things well done and chalking up debits where due. And I tell you, in the beginning, I had to do a written daily inventory because of the way I was. And the way I was is I could think anything, and it didn't sound nuts to me. All right? If I said it out loud, it sounded a little nuts. If I put it on paper and looked at it, I thought, "Whoa, that doesn't look right. I don't want to see that." You know, and I have to rethink that process and really look at that. Okay. Then there's the annual review. You know, a measure of our progress since the last time we took a real inventory, a 4-step type inventory. Many AAs go in for an annual, semi-annual house cleaning. I have a sponsor that I do this with once in a while, and I also have a spiritual advisor now that I do this with. And usually when I do it with both of them, not together in the same room, but I do it one after the other in quick succession. If somebody hurts us and we are sore and we are in the wrong also, are there no exceptions to this rule? What about justifiable anger? If somebody cheats us, aren't we entitled to be mad? Can't we be properly angry with self-righteousness? For us of AA, these are dangerous exceptions. We have found that justified anger ought to be left to those better qualified to handle it. I had an experience Halloween night. I had worked. I had promised the kids I was going to get home and, you know, take them trick-or-treating. Well, the kids. The youngest one is 13. He's the only one I wanted to go. The others, "Oh, I'm too big for this, but we'll eat the candy that he gets," you know, that type of thing. So, but I had met somebody at a meeting down at Java Club, and we sat and we talked afterwards, and I decided to start driving home afterwards, and I was tired, and I got in the car, and I'd driven from Fernandina Beach, where I was working, straight to the Java Club to try and get to this guy in time and meet with him and meet him at the meeting. I was late for the meeting, and then we talked afterwards, and I hadn't eaten, and I was hungry, and I was thirsty, and I was running low on gas, literally. I mean, the car was running on fumes at about that time. So I hate to get on Emerson. You know where Emerson and I-95? It's a real short ramp. I almost got nailed there a couple of times when I had my Chevette. So I got in the habit of not getting on I-95 at Emerson. So I turned down Phillips Highway from the Java Club and started driving down Phillips, and there's a gas station down there. And I stopped off at the gas station. I pulled up and I started walking up, you know, get some gas, and went to pay the person. And as I'm walking, there's this kid on the phone. And he's standing there, and he's talking to somebody on the corner. And he says, "Sir," he says, "can you help me?" And I walk over, and I said, "Well, what's wrong?" And he says, "Do you know anything about carjacks?" And the first thought in my mind was, carjacks? And he says, "Yeah, I can't get the jack to my car to work." And I said, "Well, where is it? You know, what kind of car do you have?" And I turn around and look around, and I turn back around, and the kid had a pistol on me. Okay? And he said the language he used got my attention. And he was threatening to blow me away right on the spot unless I stepped around the corner with him. And so I did. And there was another guy waiting there. And they demanded my money, and I gave it to them. And they were not real happy. I guess they thought I was walking into New York Diamond Exchange instead of a little champ, you know. They forget. $12, that's all you got, you know, that's everything. I mean, he was absolutely convinced I had money squirreled away in my socks and my underwear, I don't know what, but he was angry. He was an angry man with a loaded gun. And he had me turn and face the wall, and he put it to the back of my head and cocked it. And I thought, this is it. And I had a split second. I thought, I got to turn around. I got to grab this thing. You know, if I'm going to die anyway, I might as well try and stay alive somehow. And the only thing I thought of was, I'm not going to get a chance to say goodbye. You know, I was on my way home to see my kids. I hadn't seen them that morning because I got up early. I'm not even going to get a chance to say goodbye. And just as I was ready to turn around to try to grab it, to do something, you know, rather than just sit there and be a helpless victim, which I really was, somebody pulled up a car and the headlights came up and he stepped back and I didn't know where the gun was. And I guess it scared him and they took off. After taking my watch and my money. I was angry. You know, first I was scared. First I was sad that I wasn't going to get a chance to say goodbye. And I was worried about my kids. And then I was angry. I mean, I was furious. And it was my old reaction to fear. And I couldn't get rid of it. I'll be honest, I could not. I was walking around for 2 weeks, you know, looking over my shoulder. I stopped getting gas at Little Champs. You know, I stopped stopping any place at night to get a coffee to get the rest of the way home. I mean, I just got paranoid. And I couldn't stand to have somebody walk behind me. And for 2 weeks, I was just walking around. I was talking to my sponsor about it. And I talked to my spiritual advisor about it. And they advised me to pray and to pray for forgiveness. And I couldn't forgive because that guy was going to kill me. I knew he was going to kill me. And I was so angry because what right does he have to do that? And then someone asked me to speak at a place that I used to work at. Well, it was associated where I used to work as a counselor. I worked as an addictions counselor for crack cocaine addicts in residential treatment for 3 years. And I went there and I told my story and I got done and I got done talking and this kid came up and said, Jerry, do you remember me? And I did. I remembered him. I had had him in treatment years and years before. And I loved this kid. I mean, he was a neat, nice guy who just got into the wrong stuff, you know. And I said, oh, yeah, it's good to see you, you know. And we hugged and, I mean, we just sat down and we started talking. And he told me something out of the blue of how he was back in treatment again. And he told me how he got there. And the story he told me was that he had held up a man with a gun, an old man. It was not me. It's not the same kid. But he had held up an old man with a gun, and the man didn't have money, and he was going to kill him anyway. And he said, and the drug was in control. And the man said, can I pray first? And the kid thought, yeah, go ahead, you know, beg God for your life. And this old man said, Father, forgive him. He didn't know what he's doing. And the kid said, then I realized I didn't know what I was doing. It was the drug in charge. And that's when he went back into treatment. And I mean, he told me that story, and I could not be mad at that kid. It was somebody that I had known, and I could not be mad at him. And the anger for the other guy it's gone. You know, because I began to recognize what happened. That guy wasn't in charge. I mean, he was talking so fast. I wish I had a tape recorder. I could put it back on slow speed just to hear what he was saying. But he was angry. He was, I'm sure, addicted to crack or something, because he was just going a mile a minute and shaking all over the place and angry as all get out. Is this thing on? I turned that off, didn't I? Beg your pardon. So I got to do something with my anger, you know, and sometimes all I can do with it is just keep working on. I had another incident that happened. My anger was one of my greatest character defects, dishonesty and anger. And anger comes after fear. I was talking with my wife one night at the dinner table, and we were talking about a career change for me, about going back into counseling. okay, or becoming a counselor or working in addictions out of sales, out of advertising sales. What a career change. I was going to have to go back to school to do all this and all this kind of stuff. And what happened was we were talking about her maybe going back and starting to teaching to kind of help, you know, bring in some extra money while I was going to school. And it was a long, drawn-out conversation, okay? You remember me telling you about my dog? You know, I housebroke this dog when I was drinking and then urinated on the couch when I passed out and then blamed the dog for it the next day, you know, come here, look what you did. You know, and after a while, I'd call the dog and the dog wouldn't come anymore, you know. Come here. It's not mine, you know. Dog thought I was nuts. I mean the dog literally did stop coming when I called it. But anyway, this dog was my barometer, okay? And I'll explain that in a second. So Mike interrupted us, Ann and I, when we were talking, and I said, Mike, don't interrupt. And we went on with the conversation, and he interrupted a second time. I said, Mike, stop interrupting. And he did it a third time. I said, Michael, you know, and the fourth time he did it, I had a paper napkin in my hand. And I just scrumpled it up, and I balled it up, and I threw it at him and screamed across the dinner table, stop interrupting, you know. And for a split second, I mean, I got angry, and for a split second, I saw the old fear come back. And he got up, and he walked, and went into the bedroom. Well, see, I thought I was justified. It talks about justification and so forth. So I'm in there, you know, that he needs to learn some manners. I mean, I am his father, and I am supposed to teach him some manners and all that. And I'm, you know, so I went out that night, and the way I did the 10th step is I would walk this paranoid dog. I take the dog outside and talk out loud. Remember I told you if I think something, it doesn't sound nuts if I talk out loud, you know? And there's the neighbors, you know, there he is talking to the dog again, you know? And I'm outside, you know, and I got this dog on a leash, and it was before we had a fence, and I'm talking up to the stars. I'm talking to HP because I'm doing my 10-step in between. I said, I was right, HP, wasn't I? I mean, I have a responsibility to teach him manners, and it's my job, and I was right, and he was wrong, isn't that right? And I looked down, and here was the dog. Oh, God, he's going down. I mean, tail between its legs, all hunched over, just, oh, he's going crazy again, you know. That dog was my barometer. You know, I looked down and saw the dog, and it said, I'm wrong. I'm wrong, you know. And I started thinking about it. I said, I don't know how. And I really didn't know how. I said, I'm wrong. So I, you know, come on, dog, you know. And I don't want to go with you, you know. The dog finally gets inside, I turn it loose, you know, runs, hides behind the couch. Here he goes again. And I went into Mike's bedroom, and Mike was up in the top bunk, and I said, Mike, Daddy's sorry. I said, I shouldn't have yelled at you like that. And he says, Dad, he says, I'm sorry too. He says, you know, I didn't know I was interrupting. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, every time you and Mom stopped talking, I thought you were done. See, it was such a long, drawn-out conversation that he couldn't follow it, and when we paused to collect our thoughts or to stop for breath, he thought we were finished with the conversation. So he really did not realize. So we hugged each other, you know, and I asked his forgiveness, and he went to bed and slept peacefully that night, and I went to bed and slept peacefully that night. And you know how that would have been in the old days? Man, I'd had a resentment against that kid for a month. You know, in the old days. But see, I don't have to hold on to that stuff. We're going to make mistakes. I think in 1935, when they put these steps together, they said, you know, there's going to be this guy born in about 8 years that's going to need this 10-step. So anyway, that's part of how it works. I don't have to carry this stuff around with me. I don't walk around with me. I don't have to have it eat its way inside. I don't have to have it piled up anymore. When it comes up, you deal with it. You deal with it when it comes up. I used to be very concerned about what people think of me. And one time after, I had a pigeon that at one time that asked me to bail him out of jail for the umpteenth time, and I didn't do it. So I guess he got a resentment, and he started a rumor that I was drinking. Well, you got to understand, I am not what you would call a stealth relapser. I mean, if you heard my story, you would know that I'm not what you would call a stealth relapser. You know, if I relapse, everybody would know it. You know, the jails, the hospitals, my sponsor, you know, the fire department and so forth, everybody would know it. But anyway, I got real upset because I started hearing about this when I went to meeting. Here I am, I'm going to meetings and staying sober. He just comes in, spreads a rumor, goes out and gets drunk, right? So I'm hearing about this and I get all upset and I go to my sponsor. And a guy told me, a very spiritual man said, Jerry, he says, the measure of your spiritual progress is not what people think of you. He says, the measure of your spiritual progress is what you think of others. And it's one of those things that your sponsor tells you, and it kind of goes, whoa, you know, I think I missed something, you know, and you got to go home and think about it for half an hour, and then about 2 days later, you go, oh, yeah, you know, now I get it. It was that kind of a deal. But when something bothers us, we go talk about it immediately. We deal with it immediately. I also had, we tend to cover things up. It talks about big shotism. I eventually did become a counselor, and I was one of the first people to treat crack cocaine addicts in Jacksonville, and I thought I fancied myself somewhat of an expert. They asked me how many stayed clean and sober, right? But anyway, at one point in time, my boss, and I was working for an agency that was partially funded by HRS, said, Jerry, your charts are not up to date. I says, well, yeah, I know, but I'm spending all this time with the clients and they really need me. She says, well, we're funded by this organization, and if it's not on paper, it didn't happen. You need to bring your charts up. I will as soon as I can, right? About 2 days later, she says, Jerry, you know, your charts are still not up to date. Well, I know. I says, do you need help? Moi? Need help? Are you kidding? You know, not me, you know. So I'm denying that I have a problem with catching up on this stuff, that I need help. She says, well, if you need help, we'll give you help, but you got to catch these charts up to date. Well, the third time, she gave me a written warning in my personnel file and gave me 3 days off without pay to think about it. And if I didn't catch those charts up to date, she was going to fire me. And I'll tell you what, she doesn't understand what I'm doing. You know, what I'm doing is the most important thing. And you know what I tend to do? I tend to do what I like first and postpone what I don't like. Okay? And I didn't like to do paperwork. And I had procrastinated until it started piling up. So I get home and I got this resentment and I call my sponsor. You know what? And he lets me run all the way down, right? And it just wear all the way down, just like a battery, you know? And I get all done and he says, Jerry, you know what it sounds like to me? Know what? He said, same old shit, different rapper. I mean, I got science boxer, you are, you know, I'll never call you when I got up, you know. And I mean, the next 2 days out of that 3 days, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking about what he said. And I start thinking, wait a minute, you know, I'm all torn up in knots. I'm going to probably lose this job, maybe throw away my career. Maybe get drunk walking around with this resentment burning around inside of me. What's the real deal? And I started looking at what's the real deal. And the real deal was I did what I wanted to do and I didn't do what I didn't want to do. Same old stuff. And then I justified and then I rationalized. And then when somebody called me on it, I got defensive and angry. Same old stuff. Years into sobriety. And you know what I had to do? I had to go back and tell my boss, I'm sorry, I need help. Admit I needed help. Okay? So she says, fine. I already got somebody else doing your group. They're probably doing it better than you anyway. You know? So why don't you take a couple of days and catch up on the charts? And that's what I did. I mean, humble pie. Okay? But you know, this stuff in us, this personality does not go away automatically. And I mentioned something the other day. I says, you know, it amazes me that people that know me today do not think of me as a hair-triggered, violent, angry person, for the most part. Okay? And, oh, you do? Oh, but in it, the ones that know me, I mean, they hear that about that part of my story, and they say, you? And that just absolutely amazes me. And then people that knew me back when I was the way I was when I was drinking can't believe the way I am today. So something has happened. Something's changed. Okay? And what has changed is that over a long period of time, and you know how we change? First of all, we don't catch ourselves at all, right? We just do the same behaviors. And then as we're doing the inventory, we get to be more and more aware of it. And we're kind of like Chris Farley on Saturday Night Live, you know, when he's interviewing somebody and then he says something stupid and he says, "Oh, I did it again, I did stupid." You know, that type of thing. We end up doing that to ourselves right after we did it. And then we start catching ourselves as we're doing it. And then we start catching ourselves right before. And what happens is just like driving a stick shift. We pause. We stop before we do it. And when you begin to do that for a long enough period of time and practice this new way of doing things, guess what eventually happens? The new way of doing things gets to be more comfortable than the old way of doing things. And it gets to be automatic. And maybe that's why people don't think of Jerry Webster as a violent, hair-triggered, angry guy anymore, whereas they did 13 years ago. Something has happened. It's taking a long time for that to happen, but something's happened. And I tell you what, at Easter Sunday, they had the theme of the resurrection at our church, and my kids were participating, and I'm so proud of them I could spit. You know, they were participating in a service, and I feel resurrected. I mean, at 38 years old, I thought my life was over. You know, I feel younger at 52 than I did at 38. You know, I feel like I've got a brand new life. Brand new life. I look a lot better too than I did at 38. Believe it or not, you know, I look like death warmed over a couple of times when I quit drinking. You know, and I dress up in a suit and people say, "You look good, Jerry. Who's your undertaker?" You know. Those things happen. I think it's the grace of God that allows them to happen. But what we have to do is we have to till the soil, we got to plant the seed, we got to water it, we got to fertilize it. He's the one that does the growing. Okay? He's the one that's got the sunshine and the oxygen and the earth and the rain. He's the one that makes the season. He's the one that does the growing. But I do have a certain part that I have to do in terms of preparing myself as a soil that he can do his work in. And the amazing thing happens to us when we do that. And I tell you, I'm just, it never ceases to amaze me. I felt so grateful this last weekend. My son called from right before he's going over to England to say hi, and my kids were all participating in church activities. And I've really been blessed, and I'll tell you what, it's a totally, totally different life. The pastor asked me to do some things for him. Yeah. The pastor in North Carolina used to ask me to stay away, you know, why I couldn't show up sober. And it just absolutely, absolutely amazes me. Absolutely amazes me. We'll talk a little bit more about the gifts, and we'll talk about step 11 next week. The thing with step 10 is, it's an ongoing thing. You can do it on a daily basis. I highly recommend that. You can do it in the evening. Make it part of your evening meditation. Okay? Do it out loud if you have to do it, away from the neighbors. Okay, write it down if you're the type of person like I was that used to con you. I used to con myself. If I wrote it down, I couldn't con myself as easily. If I said it out loud, I couldn't con myself. There are times when you need to do spot check inventory. When you feel that old, you know, bile kind of rising up, you can kind of stop yourself ahead of time, or immediately afterwards, or right in the middle of it if necessary, and undo the damage right then. And then there are the times, you know, because there are stuff, I thought I had two brain cells left when I got sober. One was crying and waving goodbye to the other, you know. But apparently my memory is coming back, because there are certain things as you go down the road where you begin to remember more, okay? And, oh, I forgot about that in my fifth step, you know. Well, there's times, maybe once every 6 months or so, where I go back and I sit down and I meet with my spiritual advisor and I meet with my sponsor and we do like a mini fifth step. And really what that is, it's that 10-step, the biannual or annual house cleaning. And it keeps it cleaned out. It keeps the garbage from piling up. If I do something on a daily basis and I do something like that every 6 months or every year or so, it doesn't have to pile up like it used to. And that's what enables us to walk around free and loose and happy in this skin. So you're not worried. After a while, you don't get worried about what you said and who you hurt, because you're taking care of business as it comes up. You don't wait for it to pile up. Love you all, and ain't a damn thing you can do about it. Thank you.